Good morning, church. Morning. How is everybody? Good. Fantastic. Originally, this sermon was going to be about an hour and a half long, but then we wouldn't be able to beat the Baptists to lunch, so I had to cut it. Oh, no, that's okay. So I want to start off by asking a question, and I also want you to think about it before you answer. I want to ask, is Jesus safe? Is Jesus safe? Our dear friend and fellow saint of ours, C.S. Lewis, wrote a really good children's series, an allegory for Christianity. In the second book, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, he has this quote. And Aslan, if you're not acquainted with Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is the allegory for Jesus. And so in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you have the four main characters, the four humans that come into Narnia. And they have a guide, Mr. Beaver. And so I'm going to read a quote of a conversation from Mr. Beaver and Susan. Mr. Beaver says, "Aslan is a lion, the great lion." "Oh," said Susan, "I thought he was a man. Is he quite safe? I should feel rather nervous about meeting a lion." "Safe?" says Mr. Beaver. "Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good." Do you guys agree with this? Yeah? Now, I'm going to ask you, I think, the most important invention in human history is the question, why? Why do you agree with this? Is Jesus not our rescuer? Is he not our salvation or our comforter? I think he is. So why isn't Jesus safe? I think in order to understand this question, we have to understand what we need to expect out of Jesus. And so we have this nice little word called Messiah. The word Messiah, Mashiach in Hebrew, or Christos in Greek, means the anointed one, God's anointed. And so there are actually a lot of people in the Bible who are messiahs. You'd be surprised. We have a whole itemized list here. Get ready. We have priests. We have Aaron, the first high priest. King Saul is a messiah. King David is a messiah. King Solomon is a messiah. And I think most interestingly, King Cyrus the Great of Persia was anointed by God to free the Israelites from exile, right? So we have a lot of different expectations of Messiah, either priests or kings generally. But in Jewish tradition, there was something that I like to call the meta-messiah. This is the Messiah above all of these messiahs. And we're actually expecting this Messiah to come since page 3 of the Bible. It's Genesis chapter 3. And we can ask, who is this meta-messiah? And we have a bunch of different expectations. The entire Old Testament, you talk about the Bible being one unified story. The entire Old Testament leads up to Jesus. So let's look at some portraits that the Old Testament paints. First, we have the snake crusher. We get this portrait on page 3 of the Bible when God is talking to the snake after the snake has tempted Eve with the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And God says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman. And between your offspring and her offspring, he shall bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel." So we have this idea that eventually somebody is going to come along that isn't just going to resist temptation, but is going to crush it. The next portrait of the meta-messiah that we get is the Lion of Judah. I made this in a different PowerPoint, and then when I switched it over, all the font got smaller, so I'm so sorry, but so is the way of the world. The Lion of Judah, in Genesis 49, we see, "Judah, your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you." Judah is a lion's cub, and from the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion and as a lioness. Who dares rouse him? This part's important. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him. So we have the snake crusher, and then we have the lion of Judah, who has his hands on the neck of the enemies and has a scepter of ruling authority over the people of Israel. The last portrait I want to take a look at, there are a lot of other portraits, but these I think are the most important, is the portrait of the Son of Man in Daniel 7. If you were to ask me what I thought my top 10 most important Bible chapters were, I would put Daniel 7 pretty high on that list. Daniel tells us in his vision, "And behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory in a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." This is Daniel 7, 13 and 14. So, a quick recap. We have the Meta-Messiah as the snake crusher, the Meta-Messiah as the ruler of Israel, the Lion of Judah. And then we have the Meta-Messiah as the Son of Man, the one who has dominion over all nations. And I think around Christmas time especially, we make a big deal about the humble beginnings of Jesus, the fact that he was born in a manger, he's from a low-class family, he was a carpenter. He grew up in Nazareth. These are all important things to look at. But a lot of times we also gloss over the fact that he has a lot of prestige going for him. You take a look at his family line. We have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's directly descended from the patriarchs. His family has been in Israel since the beginning. Then we have Judah. For reasons we've already talked about, this is important. The fact that he's going to rule over Israel. We have Ruth and Boaz, who are not exactly prestigious people themselves, but by the time that the Old Testament was being finished, being compiled, they're a part of Jewish oral tradition and religious tradition. And we have King David, King Solomon, King Josiah. These are all good kings. And not only just in his heritage, but also looking at who he is in the first four chapters of the book of Matthew, as a child, just by being born, he was a political threat to King Herod. That King Herod committed genocide. Like, this guy is a big deal. And then we have the fact that he was baptized by John and affirmed by the Father. And keep in mind that this is the same God who saved Israel from the hands of Egyptians by drowning all the Egyptians that came for him. The concept of God in the Israelites' mind is not typically a God of mercy. It is a God of salvation for the Israelites who has his hand on the necks of his enemies. And then we see in Matthew chapter 4 that he didn't crush the head of the snake, but he went further than anybody else we've seen before in that he resisted it. David with Bathsheba, he was tempted. Moses, with his anger, he was tempted, and they both fell. And we have Jesus, who was tempted, and he went through. And so we have this guy with kingly beginnings. And if you're an Israelite, you've been oppressed pretty much for 500 years straight and on and off for the last 1,500 years. Right now, you're being oppressed by the Romans. And before that, it was the Greeks. And before that, it was the Persians. Before that, it was the Babylonians and the Philistines and the Midianites and the other Canaanites. And before that, it was the Egyptians. And this man is supposed to crush the head of the snake. He's supposed to lead Israel into a golden age. Like a lion, he is supposed to lead the Jews in rebellion against Rome. And he has a crowd of people surrounding him, people who are sick of having the underhand. Imagine being in that crowd and you've heard stories and prophecies about this man that your culture has waited for 2,000 years. And I always imagine this scene, like in the Christmas story, when Ralphie has his little decoder pin for little orphan Annie, and he's in the bathroom because that's the only place that he can get some peace and quiet, except his brother is about to explode. And so his mother is like banging on the door, trying to let his brother in, and Ralphie keeps saying like, "I'll be right out, Mom." And he goes and he's writing down the code, and he says, "Be sure to," and he goes, "Be sure to what? What do I have to be sure of?" And we say, Jesus is standing up with this crowd, the culmination of 2,000 years, and he says, "Blessed are," and we're starting to fill in the gaps, and we say, "Who is blessed? Blessed are the sons of Abraham? Blessed are those who are about to overthrow the most oppressive empire in history? Blessed are those who have stayed faithful to God?" We say, "Jesus, who is blessed?" And if you've seen the Christmas story, he says, "Be sure to drink your Ovaltine." It's just a crummy commercial. So we're waiting and we're on the edge of our seats. And Jesus says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are those who make peace, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We're all on the edge of our seats and we say, "Come again? This kingdom, this Messiah we've been waiting for 2,000 years, that's not how a kingdom works. It's a little upside down. Valuing poverty, that's an oxymoron right there. It doesn't make any sense. Making peace, nations supposed to wage war, go into a golden age. We have to be meek. What even is meekness? Well, church, I'm so glad you asked. The word meek in Greek is the word praus. And it is kind of a combination of humility, submission, and gentleness. And so you can find the word praus 4 times in the New Testament. This is going to go into a lull for a lot of you, but I think it's really important. I'm so sorry. You can find the word praus 4 times in the New Testament. 3 of those times are in the book of Matthew. If you line up those 3 times, you can actually put it on something that is called a plot map. Are you guys familiar with what a plot map is? Yes. Those of you not familiar with what a plot map is, if you have any narrative story, it will fit on a plot map. And it looks like this. At the bottom, I'll use my laser here. Didn't know that I had that at first. You have the exposition. That is the setting, the time, place, the characters, and also the problem, what the main characters are going to solve, and a direction for how the characters are going to solve that problem. You have the rising action, which builds tension to the climax, and the climax is where the story is at its tensest. You have the falling action, which releases tension, and the resolution. And so if you actually put the 3 words, praus, the first one is in the exposition, the second 2 are in the rising action, and we'll talk about the climax and falling action later. So the exposition is really important. Matthew, the book of Matthew, as a narrative, follows this plot map, which is really cool. The exposition, the problem of the exposition, what we want to focus on mostly, is Jesus' temptation in the wilderness. Matthew tells us, "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only.'" I don't know about you. I used to hate this story as a kid. I thought it was overused, and just not a whole lot of depth there. But as I get older, I start to understand what insight it provides. These three things that the devil tempts Jesus with are three things that Jesus wants. I think that's invaluable. And so this, as the climax of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness, Jesus wants to be revered by King over all the earth, but not on the terms of the accuser. And so we say, well, Jesus, what terms are you going to inherit the earth by? About 10 verses later, he tells us. Third Beatitude says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. So Matthew 4 and 5 sets up the question. Question is, how is Jesus going to reclaim earth and establish the kingdom of heaven? The solution, blessed are the prophets, for they shall inherit the earth. The next few times that we see the word prophets is in Matthew 11, when Jesus says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am prowess and lonely at heart, and you will find rest for your souls. The third time we see the word prowess, Matthew calls in a really good reference prophet, Zechariah. He says, say to the daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming to you, meek and mounted on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of the beast of burden. And so we already have half the storyline right here. Quick recap, Jesus says that the meek shall inherit the earth. Jesus calls himself meek. And then we have a highly respected reference that calls Jesus meek. This is like a job interview. And so we say, what is the climax? When is the tension going to release? When are we going to actually see Jesus being meek? And we read Matthew 27:27-31. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole battalion before him, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. And twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and put a reed in his right hand. And kneeling before him, they mocked him, saying, hail, King of the Jews. And they spit on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. And when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him, and led him away to crucify him. Normal, very basic Christian thought, and this is biblical. I think you can back it up. I think it is very important and crucial to our thought process that we become Christians, we live like Christ, suffering included, and then we have a better life with God. And that's important. I think that backs up, that checks out. That implies, though, that Jesus went through suffering and death in order to take place at the right hand of God, that it's a cause and effect relationship. I'd like to propose something different, if you don't mind. What if Jesus being placed at the right hand of God was his suffering? Not a cause and effect, but that they're the same thing. Because it might have been mockery, but he had a robe placed around him. Might have been made of thorns, but he wore a crown. Even though it was just a reed, he had a scepter. He fits the criteria of the Lion of Judah right there. It might have been scoffing, but he was hailed as King of the Jews. Church, he was lifted up onto a cross, but he was exalted. I think this man who established the upside-down kingdom, if you want to find a citizen of this upside-down kingdom, there's one place, and there's only one, and that is nailed to the cross at Golgotha. The poorest, the meekest, and the most sorely tired of all men can be found. So I ask you again, is Jesus safe? And Luke and Catherine can tell you, I don't know the first thing about parenting, but I would imagine if I had a son or a daughter and I found out she was hanging out with a Jewish hippie who ended up getting killed by public officials, I don't want her anywhere near that guy. because Jesus is not safe. But it's the very things that make him dangerous that make him good. Because he doesn't say, blessed are the rich, or even the comfortable, who live, well, comfortably, while others live paycheck to paycheck. He doesn't say, blessed are the happy, who keep chasing after serotonin, feeling good. He doesn't say, blessed are the proud, who stand up to those that they think oppress them. Blessed are not the gluttons, or even just those with full stomachs, because they just stuff themselves until they can't move. Blessed are not the shortcut takers, or the innovators, who always think that the ends justify the means. Blessed are not the corrupt, who give away their integrity for pleasure or progression. Blessed are not the problem solvers or good arguers who come up with solutions that end up making more problems than before. And blessed are not those who go uncontested in their faith, for there's no way to know that it's real. In fact, 9 times out of 10, it's not. In this context, I'm not saying that these things are things that need to be fixed in society. I'm not even saying that these are things that we should fix. It's another conversation. But being a citizen of the upside-down kingdom may mean turning our definition of words like blessed upside down too. Is Jesus safe? Church, I'm going to lift up my hands, and when they come down, I want you to say the answer to that question. Is Jesus safe?
No.
One more time. Is Jesus safe?
No.
But he is good. Because he's the one who established that blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are those who show mercy, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are those who make peace, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you, persecute you, and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice, for so they persecuted the prophets and saints who came before you. Be glad, for your reward is great.